All right, Mark, how are you?
Charles, good. Good to see you again.
It's been a while, man.
Yeah, it has been.
So, I mean, what have you been up to? Let's start off there.
I've been up to a whole bunch of things. A big thing, Azure, of course.
Yep.
In fact, you're here on the day that we're publicly announcing the what we call the spring release. It's June, actually, and that's really spring in Seattle.
True.
But we've got a bunch of new features coming out. One of them is infrastructure as a service, and that's what I've been heavily involved with. I can talk about that in a minute. And then Windows Azure Websites, which Scott Goo's team has primarily delivered, which is basically lightweight web hosting.
Nice.
And we've got a brand new portal, management portal, with all HTML5 goodness, metroized, metro-optimized.
Of course.
And a bunch of other little features here and there to back things up.
Awesome. Now, before we get into infrastructure as a service, we've talked before about essentially the kernel of Windows Azure, which is the Fabric controller. Have you been doing a lot of work on that? I mean, is it evolving since the last time we talked?
Oh, yeah. It's evolving quite a bit. In fact, this infrastructure as a service support required a number of changes in the Fabric and the way that we deploy virtual machines and the way they start up and the way they get created up in the cloud, too. So changes actually all across the stack. And in fact, my role is actually in that context of serving as one of the Uber architects of the infrastructure as a service, touched on all aspects of the system.
Excellent. So as the Uber architect of infrastructure as a service, let's start at what this is. Like, what does it mean? We've all heard IaaS or whatever. Tell us what it is and at some level how it works, how it's designed.
Okay. So infrastructure as a service, let me talk about that in contrast to platform as a service, PaaS, which is what Azure has been known for, and really Azure has been considered kind of a leader in PaaS.
Mm-hmm.
PaaS is, it's a platform. You bring your apps. You don't bring virtual machines. And the runtime and the operating system and all the support for the app is provided by the cloud provider. Google App Engine is another example of PaaS. Salesforce is another example of PaaS. And we got our beginnings with PaaS, where you bring your application. It's either a website or what we call a worker role, and we stick it inside of virtual machines for you, where we're managing the operating system and .NET in there. Mm. And we do all the wiring together for you to get things going. And we've got a platform API that you call into to find out about the topology of your service. So you really have to be written for the platform.
Okay.
Now, that is great for new applications, and people really love the speed of development and the fact they don't have to worry about virtual machines and operating system configuration. But the downside of it is that you've got to write your app to the platform. And that means that if you've got existing code or applications, that they're not compatible unless you port them. So infrastructure as a service, which EC2 is infrastructure service, Amazon EC2, which is just a virtual machine hosting platform. So you actually give the platform your VM images, and then it launches the VMs, and it's got also capabilities to wire things together. But it's and Amazon, like us, has ancillary support middleware services like storage that you can call out to from these virtual machines. But they're really, you're in full control of what's in the virtual machine from the operating system on up. In fact, you can bring operating systems besides the ones that we provide you now. Mm-hmm. So you can upload a Linux VM and run it in Windows Azure. And the once you're in infrastructure as a service, the you also have another difference from our PaaS platform, which is that the PaaS is designed around a stateless model, stateless for scale out and availability. So if you want availability, just create two of the front ends, two of the websites, and they're stateless, so you can one of them can die and it's not a big deal. You just start up another one to reincarnate it. You get a lot of benefits from that, the elasticity and availability.
Sure.
With the applications that people want to run inside of virtual machines, they're written to the server model, which is I write to my disk and then I expect my disk to survive a hardware problem. I reboot it after a crash, and then my data is still there. And so making the images, the OS images and disks persistent is the key change really for us in Windows Azure to support infrastructure as a service. That allows you to upload SQL Server, for example, put SQL Server in the VM and create a database inside of that VM and then write to it. If you did that in a worker role on the PaaS side of things, the next time the server failed underneath and we reincarnated it, the database is reset to its starting state.
Sure.
Empty. So you've lost all your data. So So the model is PaaS. You externalize all your durable state to SQL Azure or to Windows Azure Storage. On IaaS, you can store data inside the VMs, and they persist across hardware and other lifecycle events. And that gives compatibility with server apps, which is allows people to bring their existing apps up into the cloud without porting them, without changing them, and just get them to run.
Awesome. A VM guarantees some level of security such that the environment can't get in.
Yeah.
But in this case, how does that work?
Well, the cloud is actually built on, our cloud is built on virtualization as a security boundary. So your VM is secure from other VMs on the same server. And that's not just from compute resources and memory and RAM and storage that's on the VM, on the server, but also network-wise, we use VLANs to isolate your machines that are part of a cloud deployment, your cloud service, from other cloud services, including even your own cloud services. If you've got two cloud services that are collections of virtual machines, they won't be able to talk to each other unless you take special steps to connect them together.
Okay.
Unless you want, I mean, they can go through their front ends, of course, if you've got what we call virtual IP addresses, which are the public-facing internet IP addresses.
Okay.
You can assign those to your cloud service, and then you can access services through those. So actually, that's leads me into another big feature set that we've got as part of this infrastructure as a service release is to support the hybrid scenarios.
Cool.
So this is connecting enterprises with services up in the cloud.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn that off. It's spring here in
Understood.
Seattle.
Well, this is a pro rig, man. You have a mic on, so it'd be good. All right.
So to connect enterprises securely with the cloud, really you want them to be part of the same network, appear like they're on the local network. So we've got this feature called Windows Azure Virtual Network, which includes a gateway service, which is based on VPN. So you have a VPN device that you wire up to the gateway, the Azure Gateway, and now you can take cloud services and put them on your local subnets. So you can basically access them as if they were inside of your own data center. So this places where this really is useful is cases like I've got a SharePoint farm up in the cloud. Now we support Active Directory in the cloud, we support SQL in the cloud, we support SharePoint in the cloud.
Great.
So you create a customer-facing SharePoint site, and SharePoint likes to be close to Active Directory because it's very chatty, so you put a domain controller up there that's actually in a forest with on-premise Active Directory, securely connected with this virtual network gateway, this tunnel, so it's on the local subnet. So these machines up here can talk, you know, the domain controllers can sync across that and authenticate with each other across that gateway. Or you could have your front ends up in the cloud getting data from SQL servers on-premise through that securely through that gateway as well.
Excellent.
So a bunch of scenarios like that opened up too with this. So one, you were asking before about what kind of changes to the fabric and what we had to do for infrastructure as a service. So I can talk a little bit about that because the model is very different. We've got the stateless model where when you have a virtual machine that's stateless, essentially we take this master image of VHD and we copy it to the server that your VM is going to run on. And then we create a differencing disk on top that is your OS disk, and you launch and you make changes to the registry that go in the differencing disk. At any point in time, you can say, repave my VM to reset it back to its original base state, and we just delete the differencing disk, create a brand new one that's off that base image that we copied there, and then you launch. If somebody else comes onto the same server and they also have that same base image, they have a differencing VHD that also references that same base. So only one copy of the image necessary because nobody can modify it directly. Now the problem is that if you modify something, you know, your registry writes go in your differencing VHD, that server fails, of course. You start up, your VM reincarnates on a different server. Now that base image is there, copy to that server. Your differencing VHD gets created from scratch, and so it doesn't reflect any changes. It looks like the base OS, essentially. With infrastructure as a service, what we had to do was persist things. And so this is an area where we took a very different approach than Amazon. Amazon has something called Elastic Block Store where they store their VM images. It's their own storage system separate from S3, which is their blob store, the equivalent of our Windows Azure Storage. it's a separate kind of place. There doesn't support the same kind of APIs. You know, it has its own model of management and reliability and replication and so on. What we decided to do was, hey, we've got a storage system. It's Windows Azure Storage. Let's use that. It's a lot of benefits from not creating something brand new. We've invested a lot in Windows Azure Storage. And we started out the project saying, if it's not good enough for IaaS, let's make it good enough for IaaS. And then we can have one storage system. And any tooling that's been created, all of the APIs, all of the investments we make into compliance, into security, into replication, reliability, mm-hmm. all of those benefit everybody in infrastructure as a service because it's built on that. And so that's what we did. So your VMs are based off of VHDs that you put in Windows Azure Storage as blobs.
Okay.
And that means when you start a VM on a server that's an infrastructure as a service VM, it's pointing at a blob in the fabric. The fabric says, this VM, the OS image is over here as this blob. And so you do reads from the, you know, that come out of the VM to read from the OS disk, and there's a driver sitting there in the host OS that says, oh, that's this blob over here. And then it does the standard blob APIs that everybody, that are fully documented, to go pull the data in.
Nice.
And service those reads.
Great.
Writes come out the same way. So that's the difference in the architecture there. And I think actually long term we'll probably go to that for all of our images, including our PaaS images, is to be based off of blobs.
Interesting. Okay. Which is super fast, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've made a ton of performance improvements to Windows Azure Storage specifically for the VM scenarios. And this preview launch right here is mm-hmm. our V1. We've got like a whole pipeline of performance improvements we've already identified and started working on to really kick some butt.
So one question I want to ask, we've talked about this before
yeah.
in a sort of science fiction-y kind of way, but at this point it really shouldn't be science fiction anymore, and that is auto elasticity.
Yeah.
That is, hey, Channel 9 super popular because Mark Rusinovich is on.
Yeah.
We only have 83 instances loaded, let's say. We need more. The system should be able to figure that out and do something about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So yeah, talk to me about it.
We talked about it being science fiction before. It's still the platform. It is science fiction.
Sure. It's a hard problem.
Yeah. So if you look at the last year, we've been so focused on this infrastructure as a service. It's been a massive effort, like I said, across everything. So this auto elasticity, mm-hmm. we need a few things to support it. One is host-level monitoring for VMs to emit that telemetry, and we've actually got some of that in this preview release. You can go and look at your VMs and see disk activity and network activity.
Great.
The next thing, of course, is then to wire that up to something that's looking at that with rules, policy that you apply that says when load goes up across these machines, then go spin up another one, or when it goes below this, then kill it. So we've got the foundation for that, but we don't have it yet. And we've actually started System Center also. They're coming off their System Center 2012 big release. And so there's resources that are freeing up there. And, you know, Server and Tools is one service. We're all in on the cloud and optimized for the cloud. So those guys now are turning their attention to helping us with things like that. So
excellent.
I think we're going to make some rapid progress now.
Great. No, I mean, clearly you're making a ton of progress. Yeah. This is really, really good news. SysInternals tools traditionally are used for, at least in my experience, with client computing, trying to figure out what the hell some rogue process is actually doing, what's going on with memory, what's the layout in memory look like, blah, blah, blah. We live in a cloud age now as well. How have your tools evolved to meet exactly what you just mentioned? I want to use SysInternals tools to understand what's going on in my VM from a low-level sort of thing.
So really, a VM that's part of a cloud service is no different than a VM that's part of a server app or one that's a desktop app. So that I haven't done anything special for the tools to support that.
Okay.
There are LiveKD, which is a live kernel debugging image snapshot tool.
Yep. Basically
what LiveKD lets you do is you run LiveKD with the Windows kernel debugger, and then you can use the kernel debugger against the live image without like using a kernel debugger. So execute commands like list the processes, and it mm-hmm. traverses kernel data structures, reading them through the LiveKD driver to do that. About a year and a half ago, I think, I worked with Ken Johnson, who some people might know as Skywing, former outside hacker that we hired in. And He's added support to LiveKD, so you can do that against VMs from the root partition, from the host OS. You can say, run the kernel debugger against this VM image as if it were, you know, I connected with the kernel debugger, and then you can say, list the processes, and you're actually listing the processes that are running inside the VM. Mm. So, and you can also take live snapshots of the VM state and save them into a dump file format so that then you can go run the kernel debugger directly against that. You maybe take it off, you copy it someplace, and then look at it.
Great.
And that's useful for troubleshooting problems from the platform perspective. For anybody that's got a virtualized environment, and like ours, you could take snapshots of VMs and then go analyze them like that.
Awesome. Now, you wrote a book a couple of years ago, or has it been a couple of years?
It came out last March.
All right, so it's been a year. I've lost all track of time.
Me too.
Because I remember you did a live KD demo at PDC10.
Yeah.
So time to me is like, I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
So your first book, I would say, is relatively successful.
Yeah.
Right?
It's actually from first-time novelist perspective, they consider it really, really successful.
Well, congratulations. So, awesome. I mean, I've read it. Colleagues of mine have read it. We've all enjoyed it. It's a little scary. I mean, it does sort of kick into the paranoia if you are a paranoid person. Now, you've written a new book.
Yep.
Trojan Horse.
Trojan Horse.
Tell us about it.
So this is, I just got this literally a few days ago.
Nice.
So it's coming out in September. It's the sequel, same main characters, and this is the advanced reviewer's copy. So it's the one that's uncorrected proofs. This is the one they give out to reviewers like Publishers Weekly and stuff.
Understood.
But this book focuses, so the first book focused on cyber terrorism, kind of what would just evil bad guys just bent on indiscriminate destruction do with malware.
Okay.
This one's focused on this other aspect that we see a lot of these days, which is state-sponsored cyber espionage. And so I put a spotlight on that in the context of some real-world events around Iran and China and the U.S. and U.K. and the story evolves that way. And I think, you know, it reads kind of like semi-real, which is the
which is what your other book did as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think hopefully in Amsterdam at TechEd Europe, we'll have you on a security panel where we can geek out about this a little more. So stay tuned for that, people. You should tune into that. Regardless, we're going to be in Amsterdam. You never know what's going to happen. But let's look at the most recent thing that just happened. I want to talk to you about this because you really understand it. I don't quite remember the name.
Which most recent thing you're talking about?
It's a virus that was so okay.
Yeah.
This is the most recent. State-sponsored viral attack on Iran.
Yeah,
that was incredibly sophisticated, and they've figured out. They think they figured out. They know who. I don't really care about who authored it. That's not my question for you. I'm more interested in the technical stuff. Like, what loopholes did they take advantage of, and how do you know? How does one go about determining what loopholes to take advantage of? I mean, you have to really, really understand unbelievable details, which is really, without source code availability, to me, is pretty amazing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So you're referring to what's called Flame, the Flame malware.
Yes, I am.
Kaspersky, I think, broke the news on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually about 2 weeks ago. But they discovered this number of samples, I think a few hundred, spread around the Middle East, and with the biggest number of samples coming from Iran. So, of course, everybody believes that this is part of state-sponsored cyber espionage. They don't know exactly when it started circulating, but it looks like at least 2 years it's been out there without anybody really noticing it. And the reason that they call it really sophisticated is not because it's taking advantage of 0 days like Stuxnet, but just because it's huge and it's very modular. And it's using techniques like Lua, which is a game scripting language, which is probably used in a lot of games on Metro.
World of Warcraft.
World of Warcraft.
Okay.
And, so it's one of the first pieces of, it might be the first piece of malware ever seen using Lua or like this. So that's what makes them think that it's, hey, it's spreading in the Middle East, not seen anywhere else, and it looks like a real serious software project instead of hackers just tossing things together. Mm-hmm. You know, with different teams, like we're the team that, and it's very modular, so it can download different modules to do things, and it does things like can listen, look at the devices that are available. It sees on Bluetooth. It can turn on the webcam and record. So things like that.
Wow.
I personally don't think that it matches the level of sophistication in terms of serious hackerism and finding problems and to exploit them, the loopholes that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think Stuxnet still wins there because of Stuxnet had 4 zero-day vulnerabilities it was taking advantage of in Windows.
Okay.
So four bugs that nobody knew about before we saw Stuxnet using them. And finding one is tough enough, finding four and then making use of them. Now, Flame makes use of some of them as well, but only now that Stuxnet has been caught using them. Also, Stuxnet's got this rootkit for a SCADA controller that is used and is targeted specifically at the centrifuges in Iran. And actually, there was a New York Times article last week that cites sources inside the administration and inside of the CIA that basically say we admit that we did it with Israelis. Mm-hmm. So it looks like it was state-sponsored. Stuxnet was state-sponsored, and U.S. had something to do with it.
Well,
which everybody guessed anyway.
Sure.
But anyway, so back to Flame. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about Flame, and this just came to light in a blog post we made over the weekend, was that some of the Flame binaries are signed and look as if they were signed by Microsoft. Now, Stuxnet had signatures on some of their binaries, some of its binaries, that made them look like they were from Realtek and Micron to OEMs, Microsoft IHVs.
Okay.
But those were signatures.
Independent hardware vendors.
Independent hardware vendors. And those signatures were generated by stolen signing certificates. So somebody had gone into this office park, it looks like, in Taiwan, where these guys' companies are both based, and managed to get in there and get the signing certificates out and then sign Stuxnet binaries. The thing about Flame's signature, which says Microsoft on it, is that they basically reverse engineered a signing certificate so that they could sign software that looked like it was from Microsoft. They took advantage of a weakness we've got in our terminal server licensing servers, where we have certificates on there that sign binaries and generate licenses, and the signatures are based on MD5 hashes, and they figured out MD5 hash collisions so they could generate a signature with the terminal server licensing cert and then have it applied to one of their binaries. So it looks like we signed one of their binaries. So that is a pretty interesting.
It is, and it sort of goes back to the notion of when you have structured, it's like organized crime, right? You're going to have teams of highly sophisticated engineers. So for the people who figured out the MD5 hash collisions, I'm assuming they're not the script kiddie types. And there's nothing wrong with script. You can write very advanced scripts. But I'm saying there has to be some amount of somebody who's a computer scientist that's gone to the dark side and that is able to help figure out.
Well, it could, I mean, dark side, is Stuxnet the dark side?
It's a great point. But I mean, I would argue that, you know, trying to stop somebody from making nuclear bombs that they'd probably actually end up using, whereas the rest of the world won't. And I don't mean any defense of that. This may not be true. But my point is, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, you could say, is it okay to we're in Seattle. We have a lot of freaks around here lately. Yeah. So walk into a cafe and kill four people. And then go kill another person, steal their car, and then kill yourself. Is that the dark side versus having a machine gun in Iraq and killing 40 people who happen to be wearing a different uniform?
Yeah, I mean,
it's all crazy.
Everything
is contextual, man. And you're right. I think, but the moral of the story is
there's people that think Stuxnet is evil and dark side. Right?
There is. But what I mean by that, and we've had this conversation before, the best hackers in the world are going to be the people that nobody know about, because you don't want anyone to know that you found a vulnerability and that you're hanging out in some kernel mode, weird dark place in the kernel.
Yeah, I'm sure there's dozens out there being taken advantage of we don't know about.
Exactly. So dark side, light side, I mean, you're a Jedi, but you're also a hacker. You're a Jedi hacker, right? And then you'll definitely will have the Sith style. I mean, I'm using the Star Wars stuff. Yeah. That's definitely dark side.
I appreciate the Star Wars.
Yeah, man. I don't know what to make of the Stuxnet thing, whether or not that's good or evil. I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
That's a whole different topic. But there was advanced.
Yeah. I mean, I was just highlighting that as a point. But You're absolutely right. I mean, the thing is, there's some there's science behind there. There's there's guys that aren't. I mean, the ScriptKitty guys are going out to the web, finding malware, junk malware on forums and other sites where hackers are selling stuff, kits, malware kits, and gluing it together, and they barely know what they're doing to get to that point. These guys that make something like Flame or Stuxnet, and there's more sophisticated malware out there like Alurion, which was the first 64-bit rootkit, those guys are serious people that actually understand the science of the operating system and of cryptography, that are, you know, could be hired and make good money doing that legitimately someplace, or maybe are, but
sure. I mean, if I had those kind of skills, man, the kind of hackery I would do would be to take very small amounts of almost insignificant interest in any number of banking systems, and make myself an unbelievable amount of money, and then I'll go live in Maui.
You saw Office Space,
I wouldn't
so.
Hurt anybody. Something like that, something like Office Space, but something that would actually work.
Yeah,
and take advantage of the we're all in the cloud stuff. I mean, that leads to the last question I want to ask you about this specific topic, and that is: have you encountered any serious threats and attacks to cloud operating system environments? And two, what keeps you up at night in that world? So we talked a lot about what happens on these on the clients and people find a vulnerability. Well, let's talk about cloud security.
So we haven't, we've seen the cloud being used as a platform for people to do malicious things. We've seen people use stolen credit cards to sign up for accounts. Amazon has seen that too. Amazon has seen their platform being used as malware. Now, what that doesn't keep me up at night. I mean, that's something that's just going to be a constant, persistent pest that we've got to go deal with, detecting malicious activity and then shutting down fraudulent accounts and people doing nonsense. What keeps me up at night is making dumb mistakes that let people into the system, into the infrastructure itself, with the heart of the system somehow. We just today LinkedIn 35 million passwords, leaked, and they weren't very well encrypted either. So almost all of
SHA-1, right?
Yeah, unsalted SHA-1. So almost all of them are probably going to be cracked. It's kind of mistakes like that that I want to make sure that that's what keeps me up at night. That we don't make mistakes like that. This terminal server thing, that was a mistake. Our processes broke down in letting that happen, that Flame could use MD5 hash collisions to generate certs. Because the certs that were generated to do the signing, we did it after we already knew about those problems. So somewhere, someplace, you know, our internal processes broke down. And that happens. We just need to make sure that we do whatever we can to make it not happen, and that if it does happen, if somebody does get in, that we respond to it appropriately. That's what keeps me up at night.
Understood. Now, what if some of these, you know, what if like your evil twin decided that, you know what, I'm going to build the world's first cloud rootkit, and I'm going to attack Windows Azure first because my brother works there and I don't like him anymore. You know, theoretically, you could say, well, that's not really possible. It's not the same thing as a normal operating system, blah, blah, blah. There's a kind of kernel that I've talked to you about already that I work on. Then there's the real thing that interfaces directly with the hardware, which used to be called Red Dog, which is now just Windows Server. Talk to me, though. I mean, what if, I mean, it is just software.
Well, I tell you the real risk, and actually I've started working on the synopsis, at least for the third book in this series. Is highlighting the social engineering aspect of it. Because once you get the human factor to jump technology barriers that you can't really easily overcome, and then use technology to overcome the barriers once you're inside the system and it's not set up to properly defend against somebody getting past the first line of defense, that's the killer combination. So if I was evil twin, the evil twin scenario is I'm really pissed off at this particular company and I'm willing to take my time and get in and do the job, is I'll go get a job there.
Ah.
I'll go get a job there, and I'll work my way into the teams that have super secret access, and then figure out how to compromise the system from inside.
Interesting.
And then cover my tracks while I'm doing it.
Wow.
I might have just given away the plot for the third book.
Well, you know, that's actually would be a really interesting story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean...
Actually, and if for people that want to see just how effective social engineering can be, Kevin Mitnick, who actually wrote the foreword for Trojan Horse. He was considered the world's most notorious hacker back in the day. He got put in prison for 5 years because the prosecutor argued that to the judge that he could call up NORAD on the phone and whistle nuclear launch codes.
Wow.
To launch it, because I guess he'd watched war games.
Okay.
And so Kevin published a book on his life. After the court order on him being able to talk about his own life expired. Mm-hmm. It came out last summer. It's called Ghost in the Wires. And just amazing stories of him socially engineering his way, plus, you know, hacking. The two are, like I said, a killer combination to get access to things that he shouldn't have been able to get access to.
Sure. Well, I mean, we live in a world of, you know, let's be honest, it's computing everywhere.
Yeah.
There's computers in everything. And they're really a big part of our life, from the telephones that really used to be telephones, these computers we carry in our pockets, to any number of other technologies, to cameras, to whatever. Your fridge, your toaster, clearly your television and your stereo. I mean, and the question I have is, the landscape upon which, you know, people who want to do bad things to people in a virtual way, there's a lot of green field
there. Are. Yeah,
and
there's a lot of people out there that think they can hide in the numbers too.
Ah,
people can hack me, potentially get in, but I'm just one of a million targets, so I'm safe and I'll hide in the numbers.
Interesting. That's not a good.
I think that there's a lot of that out there.
Really?
Right.
Okay.
So this is the other book that's come out since the last time we talked.
Yes.
Windows Internal 6 Edition.
Okay.
It's part one. This is on Windows 7 and Server 2002, so I know it's not...
It's not Windows 8,
It's not
man.
Windows 8, it's not timely, but it's... I mean, doing one of these while you're doing other job...
Yes.
...is...
you don't have to give that excuse. People are very... There's 650 million licenses sold for this operating system.
Yeah, and actually this... it's 700 pages... This part one is 700 pages. Part two's another 700 pages. So it's a lot of material.
Interesting.
But part two will be out probably in about a couple months. We're done with it. It's just a matter of going through the publishing process now.
Always great to talk to you. We'll be checking out your great talks at TechEd.
Yep.
And we'll see you on Channel 9 Live in both Orlando and Amsterdam.
Sounds good. Yep.
So thanks a lot,
Thanks
Mark.
For coming by, Charles.
Yeah, great to see you.